From WXXI News, this is Education Friday on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in the 1890s. Peter Ilyich Tchaikovsky was at the height of his career. In his 50s, he was, for the first time in a long time perhaps, reasonably happy, his newest symphony a smash success. But alas, Tchaikovsky made the foolish mistake of drinking unboiled water in a restaurant. He contracted cholera and died just a few days later. Or so we've been told. You see, history has a way of occasionally getting it wrong, especially if you're not careful with who is writing the history, and the real story of Tchaikovsky's death, best we can tell, at this point, is told in a new episode of Scandalous Overtures on Aura TV Online, hosted by the great Robert Greenberg, himself a composer, one of the great music educators of our time. Greenberg has hosted dozens of courses on music for the Great Courses series. He's hosting the new Scandalous Overtures series, and this hour, we talk music education. I am thrilled to welcome Robert Greenberg. Robert, how are you?
I'm very well, Evan. Thank you.
And I hope you're doing well in California, reasonably well anyway. We've been concerned about our friends on the West Coast, and I hope you're well.
Oh, we're fine. We're up pretty high, so the water just runs down into the unfortunate folks that are next to the streams and the gullies, but we don't have the kind of mudslides and hills giving way that are going on in Southern Cal right now, so it's just been wet, but we need it, so good for us.
All right. Well, you know, I have been such a fan of your work with the Great Courses for a long time, and Aura TV's launch of Scandalous Overtures, which our listeners can find very easily right now on Aura TV, ORA.TV, gave me a great excuse to reach out and ask if you'd join us here. But give us a sense for what Scandalous Overtures is aiming to do.
Well, you know, it's aiming to do a lot of things, but primarily, and I'll take the high road first, it aims to humanize these composers who have otherwise been idealized to the point of deification. You know, we talk about dead Euro males like, Brahms and Bach and Mozart and Haydn, and there's a lot of crust that's been attached to their memories because their music seems so almost superhuman. So I'm just trying to knock that down, to tell you the truth. These were working people who created marvelous music because that's how they made their livings. But that music is really accessible, and it's really timely, and it belongs to all of us. And part of the process of ownership is also understanding the creators of this music as people, like us, having some metaphoric connection. So first and foremost, a series like this, and frankly all my teaching, is meant to celebrate the music and the people and times that created that music in such a way to give us ownership. So the series is doing that by dealing with salacious detail, and that's the other thing, of course. Someone will say, oh, my goodness, this is nothing but tabloid TV, gossip journalism, masquerading as some kind of informational episode. And you know what? That's exactly right. I'm taking an episode, and a single episode in the life of whomever I'm studying at that moment that we're talking about, an episode that person would just as soon no one would have known about. You know, while we're alive, we can guard our legacies. Once we're dead, I'm sorry, it becomes public knowledge. And so I'm just choosing things that these guys would probably rather we didn't talk about in an attempt, again, to humanize and make their issues contemporary with our issues.
I think you're accomplishing it in these 8-minute episodes that fly by, and I think in many ways what is very possible to happen is someone comes in, checks out 8 minutes on Tchaikovsky, 8 minutes on Haydn, and they might not naturally gravitate toward Haydn's music, but it's sort of a background character in the story that you're telling. But then they go, wow, this guy really was a rock star of his age. How come I don't know Haydn? And then all of a sudden they're on Spotify trying to find Haydn's music. And I think there's sort of a natural, I think storytelling, great storytelling, leads to those dominoes to fall, don't you?
That's exactly what I'm trying to do. And, you know, from a personal point of view, and I left this out just now, because the other thing this program is about is an attempt to help promote these courses I've been doing for the Great Courses for over 20 years. You know, I've created a pretty big body of work out there of biographies and courses about genres of music and such. And these are in-depth courses. For example, there's an 8-lecture 6-hour course on Haydn, for example, just a biography, a musical biography. Well, if someone's tickled by what they hear on Scandalous Overtures, it's easy enough to go on to the Great Courses website and get something a little more substantial. The beauty of a course that you can listen to, the likes of which I make, is that there's music to be heard as well as words that inform. And, you know, not listening to music while talking about it is like reading a cookbook. I mean, I love the pictures, but I want to taste it. And the beauty of being able to play music while you teach it is that you're tasting it while you go.
We're going to do our best this hour to do a little bit of that as well. And in fact, I should tell our listeners, Robert Greenberg didn't ask me to pump up the Great Courses, but it is just so easy for me to do because what those courses have done is truly humanize them. And I'm going to give some examples on this, and there's a lot of different ways we could take it. But I'll give you an example with Schumann here. What I'd like to do is listen very briefly to John. It's 0611133. That's our clip here. It's Schumann. He wrote a series of spirit variations. And what I'd like to do first is just let's listen to maybe 15 seconds or so of this music, and then we're going to reframe it with context. So let's listen first. And so, okay, it's nice, you know, without context, you hear that and you say, oh, that's sort of pleasant. What I learned through Professor Greenberg and the Great Courses is that, and John, stop it for there because we're gonna reboot it in just a second. Robert, I learned through you that piece of music was essentially the last clinging moment of sanity, or maybe not even sanity, but this was a guy who was starting to die, starting to go mad, and he was dealing with these voices, this mania, hyenas and devils screaming at him all the time. It was hard enough for him to sleep, and his poor wife was just at her wit's end trying to help him. And all of a sudden, in the middle of the night, at, I don't know, 2 a.m, he gets out of bed and goes to the piano, and it's as if those voices had changed to angels, right?
That's exactly what he said, is that he was in the final stages of syphilis at this time, and the third stage, and he was going mad, and he did die quite insane. And just before he attempted suicide and was institutionalized, he was hearing voices, he was seeing things, he was hallucinating constantly, and suddenly these devils and hyenas and terrifying images became angels. And he sat down, and this is the music he said that the angels were singing to him. And it's very moving, and it's very powerful, because here's a brilliant man in the throes of insanity, and the last thing he left behind for us is this gorgeous angelic music.
Can we listen again? And this time I will tell our listeners, I sat in my car listening to the lecture from Robert Greenberg, and I cried. And I listened to it with the context of knowing that, to me, this was a composer only in his 40s who knew that he was dying, and he... The music to me, and people might interpret it differently, but it almost says to me, okay, I'm ready now. I've had a body of work, and I wish it were longer, but this is, you know, music is beautiful, and I've had a career, and I can almost accept it. And let's listen again now with the context of what Schumann was doing with the spirit variations. For me, Professor, every time I hear it now, thanks to the stories you told, the meaning will be different, and I appreciate that.
Thank you. I can't imagine any other way to listen to music. It's not how we watch baseball. It's not how we watch football. We don't forget all the rules and go in and just follow it as if it has no context. We understand what's supposed to happen, and then given that understanding, the nuances that occur in any particular game make sense. There's a context. So I'm a huge believer that the more you know about something, the more you enjoy it.
Why do we so rarely, and maybe I'm being unfair, or maybe I'm overgeneralizing, but why isn't music taught that way a little bit more, with the excitement of great storytelling like you do, that makes me say, oh, that's beautiful music, but wow, what a powerful moment in that person's life. What an amazing piece of music.
You know, I don't think it's just music either. There's this whole big history movement going on right now. I don't know if you know about this. Bill Gates, for example, is putting his considerable money behind an entirely new approach to teaching history, and that is to contextualize things, not just name facts. That history is storytelling. It's the human story. And, of course, facts are very facts are changeable. And we all know that any fact can be interpreted different ways. So the question now becomes, what's the big line? What's the storyline? What's the narrative? Because that's how our brains work. We want to organize the seemingly random chaos of our existence into stories. And in doing so, we can grasp that chaos. We can create metaphors and analogs. We can understand the past. We can anticipate the future. So I think that that way of teaching history, which is really human experience, right? I mean, you say history, it's such a dry word, it's like the word lecture. I mean, it doesn't tell you what's really going on. I don't lecture. I tell people stories based on my interpretation of the facts as best as I can figure them out, with the support of material. The beauty of teaching music is that everyone likes music. So, again, it's like food or wine. I'm talking about something folks are interested in. Statistics would be very hard to teach for me. But anyway, back to your question, I think this is kind of a problem across the board, and that is, how do we teach everything? Do we bring in a holistic view that keeps the human element strong, or do we simply report facts and dates and names without context? I can't tell you that I ever had a really good history class growing up, going to school. Maybe my senior year, maybe AP history in high school, a guy named Walter Nolner. Yeah, Mr. Nolner was very cool. He told great stories. He made sense. He made the materials come alive. But that's what we're looking for, really. We're looking for a narrative that allows us to tap in personally to the story being told. And I guess I'm just a good storyteller.
You are. It helps that you also, Robert Greenberg, my guest for the hour, told Larry King, who is also hosting on Aura TV, that his mind collects knowledge the way windshields collect bugs. And that's a helpful thing. It certainly manifests in a very fun way on the Great Courses, and you can find the Great Courses. GreatCourses.com is courses of all kind of different genres and subjects, but Robert Greenberg's work on music, easy to find. And on Aura.tv, ORA.tv, Scandalous Overtures. I'd like to listen to a clip from Tchaikovsky. Scandalous Overtures tackled Tchaikovsky, and you talk about humanizing somebody. Look, we could debate for a while just how uncomfortable we are with his relationship, not with men, but with underage boys. And I don't want to touch that right now. What I do want to talk about is the fact that if you go to Wikipedia, Tchaikovsky's death is still listed as, well, probably cholera. I mean, it's 2014, for goodness sake. Mm-hmm. And here is Robert Greenberg on Aura TV talking about what really did kill Tchaikovsky, which, how heartbreaking in 2014 especially, to think that he was gay, he was desperately scared that the world would find out, he actually constructed a marriage that he had no interest in just to try to create this facade, that fell apart almost immediately, and finally he was confronted by a group who knew he was gay and wanted to out him. And let's listen to Scandalous Overtures, Robert Greenberg talking about Tchaikovsky. This is 06130. John, let's listen.
Tchaikovsky had been informed that the letter would be delivered to the Tsar unless he committed suicide. Tchaikovsky, his worst fears realized, had agreed. The next day, Tchaikovsky began taking arsenic in small doses. Arsenic was chosen because the symptoms of arsenic poisoning are similar to those of cholera. Severe diarrhea, followed by explosive vomiting, and within a few days, collapse and death due to kidney failure. Tchaikovsky believed that by faking cholera, he could avoid exposure and disgrace. What a terrible thing. This degree of fear and self-loathing. Would Tsar Alexander III have punished Tchaikovsky for his homosexuality? Of course not. Tchaikovsky was a national hero. But Tchaikovsky didn't understand that. And so, having sworn his brother, his doctor, and his friends to tell the world he had died of cholera, this gentle man, who had so much life and music still in him, died an agonizing death from self-administered poison.
That's Robert Greenberg in the Aura TV series on Tchaikovsky's death. You know you've got colleagues who still want to fight you on that, Robert.
I know. And we'll never know for sure. But it's not just smoke here. I mean, there's a conflagration the size of New Jersey. It's interesting. First, the Imperial Russians and then the Soviets did everything they could to suppress. There had always been talk that he committed suicide and that he committed suicide by drinking bad water, although he got sick within hours of supposedly consuming this bad water. And everyone I've talked to and everything I've read indicates that you don't get sick with cholera in 2 hours, in an hour and a half. There's an incubation period. So it's unlikely that if he did commit suicide, which he almost certainly did as far as I'm concerned, it's unlikely he got it from drinking bad water, which he would not have done. He would have made sure he was going to get sick. You know, he once tried to commit suicide back 25 years before when his marriage was, you know, disintegrating as it should have after 10 weeks, and his suicide attempt was really very lame. It was October, and he waded into the Moscow River, thinking that he would catch cold and catch pneumonia and die. His mind had gone a little bonkers at that point. He had a nervous breakdown. So his brothers pulled him out of the water, and they carted him away. He never saw his wife again. That was a cry for help. But what happened at the end of his life was not a cry for help. It was definitely a suicide attempt. The Soviets censored his letters. They censored his materials tremendously. I mean, anything that referred to his homosexuality, anything that referred to the demi-monde in which he lived with his friends, was expunged that the Soviets could get their hands on. Now, a lot of stuff they couldn't get their hands on, but boy, they did a really good job of wiping out a lot of Tchaikovsky stuff. His letters are filled with these impenetrable black marks, or simply stuff was cut out. And the Soviets had a long time to do that. I mean, they sat on the Tchaikovsky archives for 70-some-odd years. So only now, with the demise of the Soviet Union in 1991, only now really are little bits and pieces of the truth coming out. But it makes no sense to read the official story. It makes no sense. The claim remains that Tchaikovsky and his brother, just a few days after the brilliantly successful premiere of his Sixth Symphony, go to a restaurant in St. Petersburg, which is where Tchaikovsky was at the time, called Leinert's. And Leinert's was a very famous, very high-end restaurant. And it's during a cholera outbreak. And during a cholera outbreak, and this was common in St. Petersburg because everyone flushed their toilets right into the Neva River, during a cholera outbreak, it was law, prescribed law, that you had to boil water before drinking it. But a restaurant like Leinert's would not serve tap water anyway. And Tchaikovsky always drank bottled water. So we're supposed to believe that Tchaikovsky ordered a glass of tap water. Then we're supposed to believe that he was told by the waiter, we're not boiling the water. And then we're supposed to believe that Tchaikovsky said, fine, I'll drink your unboiled tap water here in the finest restaurant in St. Petersburg. And then we're supposed to believe that 2 hours later, 3 hours later, he's suddenly sick with cholera. Then we're supposed to believe that he refuses to see a doctor for 3 days, because that's what happened. He refused to see a doctor for 3 days. Because a doctor would have seen he was poisoning himself. And when he finally saw a doctor, he only had a couple of hours to live. So, I mean, really, it just one does not have to be a forensic medico to see that this is just absolutely absurd.
And achingly sad that a man could never really come to grips with his own sexuality, and it led to his death. Now, talk about humanizing him. This time of year, we hear Tchaikovsky's name. We hear it with a nutcracker. But I have to tell you, a good friend of mine who listened to your great courses course on Tchaikovsky before I did said, "You can't fast forward to the end, but you will not believe what we didn't know about the way he died. Well, what I loved in that course, the entire course, was the fact that there are big, obvious Tchaikovsky masterpieces that we know, but then there are, that's probably just inevitable that when a man composes as much, there's a lot that we don't know. I want to listen to John 06138 at the bottom of your list. I have this on my regular rotation now. Thanks to Robert Greenberg, I had no idea. Violin Concerto number 35, Tchaikovsky. This is one of my favorite pieces of music ever, and I'd never even found it until Professor Greenberg. Let's listen. I could listen to it all day, Professor, but I will also say that your course reminded us that even the greatest works of music are often panned when they first come out, and that was viewed as too skittish.
Edward Hanslick, the great and authoritative Viennese critic, said about that last movement, I can't recall it verbatim, but it was to the degree that this is music that stinks of Russian peasantry, of their vodka-fouled breath, of their poop-stained pants. And, you know, he said that if music can stink to the ear, then this stinks to the ear. I mean, it was savage, savage. Tchaikovsky wept and wept and wept. He was a very sensitive man, a very oversensitive man, and any sort of confrontation, any sort of bad review, I mean, just cut to his heart. And, you know, he self-medicated with alcohol and tobacco, and there's no doubt he would have self-medicated with a couple of bottles of vodka after that review. So, yeah, he took a beating.
You said in that course that music is close to perfection for you.
I've loved the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto since I was a kid. There were certain family deities when I was growing up, and one of those family deities was a violinist named Nathan Milstein, and I grew up with a Milstein recording of the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto. It's always been one of my favorite pieces. And one of the nice things for me, and this is true for everyone, you know, the beauty of being a kid, let's say when you're first starting to drink wine, you don't care. Any $2 bottle of wine is going to taste as good as any $300 bottle of wine. But the older we get and the smarter we get and the more experienced we get, sadly, that $2 bottle of wine starts tasting like the swill that it really is. And the same is true with whatever we do. You know, music that we loved when we were a kid, we can just see all the holes through it when we get older. Here's a piece of music that has aged perfectly for me. I love it as much now as I did when I didn't know anything. There's just more to hear. There's more to appreciate. There's just more stuff to be amazed by. And that's nice. That's nice when you can't mature past something you loved when you were young.
We're talking to Robert Greenberg, who is the host of a new series on Aura TV. That's ORA.TV, called Scandalous Overtures. 8-minute episodes in which he peers back into the lives of these great composers, gets us hooked with sometimes salacious details, but also reminds us that they were people, that they were human beings. They were not demigods who magically created these music. That they really were human beings with human stories. And Robert Greenberg is behind some of the great music education courses that we've seen called The Great Courses, and you can find so many of his courses now on The Great Courses online. I want to listen to a chunk of the way you opened Shostakovich. For me, the Shostakovich course was another great reminder that the story that we are spun doesn't always comport with reality. And if we could, let's listen to how you, with just a smidge of editing, let's listen to how Professor Greenberg opened 06132, John, how he opened The Great Courses course on the life and music of Shostakovich, and then we'll come back and talk about that.
We were told such things. Oh, we were told, don't wave that pencil around. You'll put someone's eye out. Do any of us know anyone who put out someone's eye by waving around the pencil? We were told, don't sit so close to the television, you'll go blind. Do any of us know anyone who went blind sitting too close to a television set? The things we've been told. And because we didn't know any better, or because someone in a position of power was withholding or altering the truth, the things we actually believed. We have been told that Dmitri Dmitrievich Shostakovich was, quote, perhaps Soviet Russia's most loyal musical son, unquote. In support of such statements, we have been told, for example, that Shostakovich's Symphony No. 5 of 1937 is a perfect, preeminent example of Soviet ideology set to music, that its brilliant and stirring finale is a paean by Shostakovich to victory, to Stalin, to the new Russia, and the Soviet working class. And who can blame us for thinking that this music represents some sort of Soviet epiphany? Shostakovich himself told us so. What we were not told was that Shostakovich wrote those words with a gun to his head. The Soviets were like that.
That's Robert Greenberg introducing his course on Shostakovich. And yet, Professor, there's still some debate when people look at the memoir that Shostakovich was a part of in the years, just a few years before his death in 1975. There's still some debate, even though his own son says, yes, those were his words in that book, that he truly, truly was conflicted and fighting back internally. I can't believe there's any doubt now, but you still hear it.
Oh, there's a lot of doubt. The book you're talking about is Testimony.
Yeah.
And Testimony consists of a series of interviews he gave to someone named Solomon Volkov, a young musicologist, a music student. And the rules of the game for Shostakovich were, I will dictate, you type this up, then I'll sign my name on each chapter, but you may not publish this stuff while I'm alive. You can't. And Volkov fled to the West. He smuggled this manuscript with him. Shostakovich died, and then Testimony was published. Now, Testimony was published during the height of the Cold War. This would have been, I guess, 77, 78. I mean, the Soviets had just invaded Afghanistan. Jimmy Carter had canceled the Olympics. We didn't send a team to the Moscow Olympics. I mean, these were dark days in the Cold War. And the Soviets said that this was just another provocation by the West to try to spoil, sully, and destroy the reputation of a great Soviet. It became a political issue as much as a musical issue. Many people, many high-end American academes, excuse me, that's just another line in my house, but it will be answered.
It's no problem.
Many important American academes lined up and said, you know, this is shoddy workmanship on Volkov's point. Shostakovich would have just signed a piece of paper, and then he typed this stuff up. I mean, we don't even know this is a true signature. And a lot of people, a lot of high-end academes who had invested tremendous amounts of their own career talking about Shostakovich a certain way, were faced with a terrible dilemma. That is, do I reappraise his entire career and output based on what now seems to be a very different person emerging, or do I simply say this is a pile of crap? And sadly, a lot of people just said this is a pile of crap, if you'll excuse me. You know, their reputations were at stake as well. And we don't need to quote Testimony verbatim anymore, whether or not it was Shostakovich's voice. So much other stuff has come out since the demise of the Soviet Union that the importance of Testimony has receded quite considerably. We have corroborating words coming from so many other people that we don't even need Testimony anymore to reconstrue Shostakovich as a terrified man, but also as a very brave man who did what Soviet artists did. He said one thing in public, his works meant one thing, and then he said another thing in private. That's how the Soviet artist class survived these absurd strictures. I mean, it was like living in Oz, and this is how people dealt with Oz. They said one thing and did another. The level of cynicism, the level of irony in the mind of the Soviet artistic and intelligentsia class is just, we can't even identify it. We Americans are so marvelously naive, because we can be, although perhaps we shouldn't be.
Well, could we listen to just a portion of Symphony No. 5 from Shostakovich?
Oh, absolutely.
And I will say what Professor Greenberg often says, whether it's on Aura TV, but especially in the great courses, these brief glimpses are almost unfair to the composer, and you know, just 40 seconds at a time is sort of cheap. But this is from Shostakovich Symphony No. 5, and I want the professor to then come back and tell us, what do we think Shostakovich was trying to say, and what do we think Stalin and his ilk were wanting to interpret? Let's listen. That sure sounds like Stalin triumphing over the Nazis to me, Professor.
Well, this is long. This is well before the Nazis. What it sounds
right.
like is the victory of the new Soviet human being, the new species of humanity, Homo Sovieticus, as they called it. And that's what Shostakovich told everyone. Now, you have to remember context. This was 1937. In 1936, Shostakovich had been censured, and it looked like he was going to be destroyed. Remember, this is during the show trials. This is during the worst days of the Stalinist purges of the late 30s. And Shostakovich himself was censured for an opera he'd written called Lady Macbeth of Mtsensk. And no one would look at him. Everyone figured he was a dead man. An editorial had appeared in Pravda, an unsigned editorial, but it was dictated by Stalin himself, and the editorial said, if music like this continues to be written by this man, it will all end badly. And in Stalin's Soviet Union of the 1930s, there was one meaning. So Shostakovich kept his bag packed by the door and waited for the Black Maria, that black SUV, to come pull up and take him away, and he would have disappeared like so many millions did disappear in those days. But he didn't disappear. He was given another chance. He was allowed to write this Fifth Symphony, which was make or break. Either he was going to be redeemed and rehabilitated, or he was going to disappear. And that's work-related pressure, as far as I'm concerned. So he told everyone he was writing a paean to the Soviet man, to the Soviet system, that would end in victory and glory, and that's the ending we just heard. And to the uninitiated ear, yeah, well, it sounds pretty victorious. But to the people in the audience who knew what Shostakovich had gone through, who knew Shostakovich, and who understood what this music really was about, oh, it was a whole different story. You know, there's a wonderful account of that premiere night when the audience applauded for half an hour and then went out into the streets and was screaming along the streets, Shostakovich is still alive, he's one of us once again. Someone who was there was the great cellist, Mstislav Rostropovich. And when he came to the United States and settled here, he wrote about what that piece was about. He says, anyone who thinks this is glorification is an idiot. All those repeated A's we were listening to, those are sword points being stuck into the Christ's flesh. This is torture. This is the pain of the artist. People who knew Shostakovich, who understood the system, who understood how you would code your emotion, they got it. But we didn't get it in the West because we were told by the Soviets, Shostakovich is a great Soviet man, and he's writing music that glorifies the great Soviet system that ultimately will become the world system. When Shostakovich came to the United States in 1949, when he was puppeted out and someone else read speeches that he'd supposedly read that degraded the West, well, Western composers and Western musicians heaped abuse on him. I still remember my professors when I was an undergraduate. You couldn't even say the word Shostakovich. They would attack you. That music is nothing but Soviet tripe. I remember hearing that from a wonderful and well-known American composer. But it wasn't tripe, and it wasn't Soviet. They didn't get it because they didn't have to. But now we're smarter, And it's, by the way, some of the greatest music ever written.
And it's even more satisfying for me to know that personal story, to have that context, and to appreciate the man even more so for everything that he went through. Robert Greenberg, my guest for the hour, who is the host of Aura TV's new Scandalous Overtures program. You can see it on Aura TV, ORA.TV. He's also the host of so many music courses for The Great Courses online, greatcourses.com, to check that out. We've got to take a 60-second break. We're going to come back and a little bit more music, a little bit more conversation, and some of your questions answered for Professor Robert Greenberg. Short break and more coming up on member-supported public radio. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. A question from a listener who wants to know if Professor Greenberg can tell us who in modern music, and I know you get this question a lot, but here it is, who in modern music, and let's narrow that down to mainstream music, rivals the genius of the classical greats. I think that's two questions. I think partially that's in general mainstream or popular music. Is anybody really doing genius stuff? And then the other question is, in modern sense, you know, hundreds of years from now, will we be talking about current composers in the way we're talking about Shostakovich and Haydn and Mozart and so many others?
I hope so. And I will filter that down because I'm asked this question a lot. Who's Beethoven today? Who's our Haydn? Who's our Brahms? Who's our Rachmaninoff? The problem with that is that I can name names, and I'd be happy to, as a contemporary composer, as someone who is friends with other composers, and I'm part of a very important new music organization that's been putting on concerts here in the Bay Area for over 30 years. I'm real aware of what's going on, especially in the United States. And I can name these names, and people would say, who, what, how? You know, you never really know anything until people are dead and reputations can be made. And certainly, the so-called classical, or I'd rather say concert music world, as it exists today, is not what it was 100 years ago. There are so many competing media now for the ears and time of people that, you know, there was a time when opera, for example, was, in many countries, opera was the only virtual reality entertainment you could indulge in, where you could walk into somewhere and be transported to a completely different place and have all your senses addressed, not just theatric, but music as well. But now there's a million different ways we can get those jollies, whether it's in a movie house, whether it's in front of a video game. We don't need opera the way we used to need opera as a society. So certainly there's a lot of dilution of the talent pool into different places and different arts. That doesn't mean there isn't great music being composed now. There is. I just don't think people are aware of modern composers the way in other times folks were aware of their composers. Then there's, of course, the sticky and irresolvable issue of the nature of contemporary music. Composers do not work within a given period language anymore. Part of the shtick of the 20th and 21st centuries, part of the growth of the individual ego, the importance that I hold my own feelings, is that we all want our music to sound like us. And that means not necessarily writing music that follows the kind of language that we associate with the music of the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries. So what that means is contemporary music's a lot harder to listen to, or 20th century music, 21st century music is harder to listen to than earlier music. Then, by the same token, we've had hundreds of years to get used to what Beethoven sounds like, whereas in Beethoven's time, a lot of people didn't like what he was doing. In Mozart's time, a lot of people didn't like what Mozart was doing. In Bach's time, Bach was rejected as a serious composer. In fact, he was a third-string composer for those who would even talk about his music. So, you know, we've had hundreds of years to get to know them. When Bach died in 1750, I mean, maybe, I don't know, maybe 50 people who knew who he was, and maybe 10 of them cared. That's probably an exaggeration, but I'm not too far off the mark. So without time, without a chance to reflect on an entire career, it's virtually impossible to say who's big right now. And that's my cop-out. It will allow me to have cop-out.
I think it's a fair answer. Talking to Robert Greenberg, you can see his work right now on ORA.TV, Aura TV. Robert, among other relatively and certainly many high-wattage names there, Larry King and William Shatner and so many others on there, and Jesse Ventura is on there. You've got some huge personalities on there, and Robert Greenberg as well, with the show Scandalous Overtures. 8-minute online episodes available now. Let's listen to, if we could, what I want to do is I want to play a chunk of music. And again, we're talking about music in context, educating through great storytelling, which I think Robert Greenberg does above all others right now. Let's listen to a piece of music. John, it's 06127. I think everyone's heard this music, but then we're going to come back and listen to the way it's described with the story. Let's listen. Obviously a beautiful piece of music, but I'd like to listen to, if we could, just a chunk of Robert Greenberg on The Great Courses talking about Für Elise and the historical question of who really was Elise? Who was this written for? I don't know if our engineer, John Andrus, who's been listening behind the glasses, is going to get in a cage match with Professor Greenberg in a second. They might disagree. Let's listen to what Robert Greenberg said on The Great Courses about it.
The two principal candidates are a German soprano named Elisabeth Rockel and a rich, titled Austrian lady named Therese Malfatti. According to the German musicologist Klaus Kopitz, Elisabeth Rockel was part of Beethoven's inner circle around the year 1810 and might have gone by the nickname Elise. However, the general consensus is that Elise is Therese Malfatti. She was a competent musician and, based on surviving images, a dark-haired babe. Swept up in one of his periodic attacks of testosterone-induced passion, our Romeo van Beethoven proposed to Therese in 1810 when she was 18 years old. Her rejection was immediate and absolute, and thus Beethoven was able to add Therese to that long list of aristocratic ladies who venerated him as a musician but were grossed out by him as a man. The likely story is that Für Elise was composed as an offering for Therese during Beethoven's abortive courtship. As for the title, the speculation is that given Beethoven's nearly illegible handwriting, Knoll simply misread and then miscopied the inscription, turning Für Therese into Für Elise.
Okay, a couple of things here. First of all, it's just pure fun to listen to Professor Greenberg tell that story, and even if some may disagree, it makes me want to go back and listen to the music with that context that says, boy, this poor guy was a great composer, and he lived in squalid conditions, and he wasn't very attractive, and you could feel it in that music, Professor Greenberg, a little bit of rejection, I think.
Well, you know, the poor guy, when it came to women, he kept falling in love with the absolute wrong people, which was, of course, a defense mechanism to avoid women, as it turns out. I mean, he'd been witness to a horrific marriage between his parents when he was growing up, one filled with domestic violence and then his mother's early death. And so he was definitely conflicted when it came to the ladies. And so he fell in love with these tall, leggy, beautiful, aristocratic women who, as I said, adored him as a musician, but not for a second would have shared fluids with him. And so, yes, what I hear in this is he wrote a simple piece that someone could play easily. So whomever he gave this piece to, whomever he dedicated to, he wanted that person to be able to play it, and by playing it, to be thinking about him in association. So I don't think there's a rejection in this. I think there's a lot of elegant beauty,
okay.
And you know, like any gift you give someone, part of the idea behind that gift is whenever they look at this, they're going to think of me. So I think that's one reason why it has become now a favorite among music students. It's so easily played.
Admiring and longing.
Exactly. That's what I hear. Now, what does your engineer think on this?
Well, John Andrus, put the mic on. John Andrus knows much more about, he's forgotten more about music than I know. John?
I'm going with your theory, sir. I had just a Reader's Digest version of it, but I'll go with yours.
You know, I have to say, what I do is I take the sources that are there. Obviously, I'm not sitting in Vienna going through original materials. I take the sources as they exist. I take my own impression of the music, which is powerful. I like to think that as a composer, I look at a piece of music differently than someone else who's not a composer might look at it. I look at a piece of music and say, why was it written? Why were these choices made? Why these rhythms? Why these harmonies? Why this melody? Why does it work? I'm looking at it from a kind of tinkerer's point of view. What makes it tick? And that really helps me understand what a composer might have been thinking about. It's all speculation, obviously, but based on my take of a piece of music, and then the literature that's out there, I could make some pretty educated guesses. But I'm no better than my sources, and rarely do I speculate beyond sources that are already there. And in this case, you know, no one knows for sure. But sadly, the original manuscript has been lost. Part of the story that was left out is that this manuscript was discovered. Teresa Malfatti had this manuscript in her possession when she died, I don't know, something like 30 years after Beethoven died, 40 years after Beethoven died. And it was only then in the 1850s, I'm pretty sure that was the decade, that this piece came to light.
Yeah.
And the fact that it was in Therese Malfatti's hands tells us an awful lot right away. I mean, if it had been dedicated to that other lady, why wouldn't it have been in her hands? And then this guy wrote out, transcribed what he saw, and proceeded to lose the original manuscript. So we don't have the original manuscript by Beethoven. We simply have a transcription of someone who wrote it out when it came to light. And that's why the speculation is he just got the dedication wrong. And not having the original now to refer to, we can't know whether it did say Therese or not. We can only speculate.
Professor Robert Greenberg is our guest, and we're talking about music education, the masterful work he does with the great courses and on Aura TV Now with Scandalous Overtures. Let me briefly ask you, Professor, we've been talking about the value of humanizing composers. I mean, people refer way too often to Mozart as a god or claim that he had a form of autism or some kind of, you know, that it was something transcendent. That you remind us that he was a person with, frankly, a lot of immature habits as well. But we look at these guys as well and say, oh my gosh, so many of them died young. Mm. You know, Schubert, Mozart, Schumann, even Tchaikovsky didn't need to die when he died. And it just makes you ache for what we didn't have. Have you ever stopped and tried to think about the body of work that we don't have?
Well, you know, that hurts too much. Life is life. And, you know, we hear today in the world we have now with modern surgery and antibiotics, we expect people to live. Now, God forbid we do lose a lot of people young. But we expect people to be long-lived. But in other eras, and fairly recent eras, there was no expectation at all. Women didn't live through childbirth a tremendous proportion of the times. Children, you know, infant mortality, childhood mortality was terrible. Mozart himself had fathered seven children, only two of whom survived. And one of them might not even be Mozart's. So there was a proximity of death before the mid or early 20th century that's hard for us to identify with now. So I try not to get into those thoughts. Those are the crazy thoughts that can drive us absolutely nuts. You know, apparently when he died, or there's a rumor, I read it in numerous places, that Mozart was considering working with Goethe on a Faust opera in German. Now, can you imagine? It would have changed the history, first of German opera, but probably the history of opera as we understand it, had Mozart the opportunity to write a vernacular German opera with someone of Goethe's talent. And it would have changed everything. You think about these things, you go crazy. I mean, Schubert dying at 31. Insane stuff. Beethoven at 56. I mean, that was a fairly old age at the time, but still, he was just... I've well outlived Beethoven. I still remember, first I outlived Schubert, then I outlived Mozart, then I outlived Chopin, then Gershwin, then Schumann. Now I've outlived Beethoven, and I'm creeping up on Bach, and that's scary because these guys accomplished world-shaking things. And I'm still trying to figure out, you know, when I grow up, what I'm going to do for a living.
I think you're doing it beautifully, Professor.
Thank you. I appreciate that. But yeah, disease, you know, tuberculosis, infections, they claimed so many people so young, and that generally doesn't happen to us now. Now we get old enough to get cancer, and those, you know, everyone talks about the cancer rates were lower then. Well, one reason why they were lower is people weren't old enough to get cancer. So it's something I think it's best we not dwell on.
Well, there you go. In 15 seconds, what's next on Aura TV on Scandalous Overtures?
Beethoven is coming out. Beethoven is coming out on the 16th, which is his birthday.
All right. Professor Greenberg, it's my honor to have you here. So much of what little I know about music, and that hopefully is expanding, is thanks to you. And the appreciation I have, and I can't even say enough about the great courses, Aura TV, Scandalous Overtures. Thanks for what you do, and thanks for taking the time for us today.
Thank you so much, Evan, for your good words.
That's Robert Greenberg. Professor Greenberg, you can see him on Aura TV, ORA.TV, Scandalous Overtures, The Great Courses, and more. He's even a composer, and you can seek his work out online, I'm sure, as well. John Andrus, great fun this hour. Thank you for your wonderful engineering work. Have a great weekend. I will see you on Monday right here on member-supported public radio.